All right, how you doing? This is Michael Slate. Welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm really excited about today's show. All right, we got a great lineup for you. But there's something I wanted to read first because I always end up, this stuff always ends up getting pushed to the back end of the show, and I don't want to have it lost there, okay? And in the wake of all the fuss that's been going on about elections and all this other stuff, there's something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, that I thought would be very cool to read today and sort of set a different tone out there, and people can write to me and tell me what they think about it. All right, here it goes. The much-proclaimed democracy under this system is a sham, and worse. It promotes the illusion that it is expressing the will of the people while really involving the people in legitimizing the rule of a rapacious and murderous class of capitalist imperialists who dominate and shape the electoral process and political decision-making overall and whose rule is in reality a dictatorship that fundamentally relies on brutally oppressive force and violence. Once again, something to think about. And that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. All right, so for today's show, at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking about debtors' prisons in the U.S. And joining us, there's an ACL lawsuit in Washington State that recently succeeded in ending the practice of locking people up for unpaid court costs in Benton County, Washington. But these debtors' prisons are common in many states across the country. And we're going to be talking with Prachi Dave, a staff attorney at the ACLU of Washington State, and Nusrat Chowdhury, staff attorney for the ACLU in New York City. All right, so we'll be talking about that at the back end of the show. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to really bring you a segment that I recorded just last week with Jerry Lemke, talking with us about his latest book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America, the question of PTSD's post-traumatic stress disorder, which was first formulated following the Vietnam War, is still as current and controversial as ever. And Jerry Lemke shows how medical talk about PTSD is used to undercut the powerful actions of anti-war GIs and veterans from Vietnam to the war in Iraq. Jerry Lemke is an associate professor of emeritus of sociology at the College of Holy Cross and the author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. So without any further ado, Teddy, let's hit it. Let's listen to Jerry Lemke. Back a little while ago, I interviewed a man named Jerry Lemke, and it was about his book, The Spitting Image, which actually I was really, really happy to be turned on to when I worked with David Zeigler on his film, Sir, No Sir. And The Spitting Image was about this mythology of what was happening to Vietnam vets by anti-war people in the U.S. when they returned from the war. And it was a whole mythology that was built. It was part of basically, this whole reactionary trend to try and sum up this or to try to break this influence, what was developing as a really very important relationship between anti-war vets and veterans and the anti-war movement as it stood that in those days. In the course of reading that book and then later talking with Jerry about it, I came across his book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. And Jerry Lemke, he's just written a very powerful book there again. He's Associate Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to the show, Jerry.
Good to be with you again.
Well, let's jump into it because, man, I have got like 18 pages of questions for you, okay?
All right, that's like, good.
Yeah, it's very heavy here. So this whole question of PTSD, it is controversial. It's still very much alive today. I was just talking with my assistant producer, and we were remarking about how in the LA Times, either yesterday or the day before, was a whole big story about vets in the U.S. and how they're being hooked up with horses and training horses and riding horses and taking care of horses as a way to relieve their PTSD.
So, oh, my.
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah. So it's very much alive today in terms of war and veterans. What is it and where did it come from?
Oh, well, I think it's good, first of all, that you began with a reference to the book, The Spitting Image, because I think that both of these, the mythology of spat upon veterans and this narrative of wounded veterans, people coming home from war, traumatized, are really two parts of the same story. They both work to construct an image of veterans as victims, and both of those worked, particularly in the 70s and maybe in the 80s, actually it still works today, really to offset or to displace the idea that war can be a very politicizing and very empowering experience for men who are sent off to war. Certainly that was the case with Vietnam veterans. Many of us, I say us because I'm one of them, came home from Vietnam really very much ready to join the anti-war movement. we didn't think of ourselves as victims at all. We didn't think of ourselves as traumatized at all. And most historians find that we were a very important part of the anti-war movement. Now, if you run the clock ahead to the 1990s after the first Persian Gulf War, and even more today after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you ask the question, so why aren't people coming home from these wars the way Vietnam veterans came home with this attitude of ready to traumatize Richard Nixon when we came home? What has happened in between? And I think that what happened then, that we go back and decide this new image got created. The media, Hollywood played a huge role in this, portraying Vietnam veterans as pretty much damaged goods and not portraying the political images of Vietnam veterans at all. So the culture really pushed off screen the idea of Vietnam veterans as political actors, put in place Vietnam veterans as victims, and that image of how men come home from war then is what really caught on with this new generation of veterans, and more important than that, really caught on with the American public. The subtitle of my book is Diagnosis and Identity. It's the identity word in there that I think is most important, and I'm sure we'll get to this, we'll come back to this, but the idea of trauma, the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder almost being a credential for the wartime experience. And it's something that people now expect veterans to come home with, expect our soldiers to come home displaying these symptoms of having been stressed out. So the whole imagery has really gotten inverted. And I think that there are greater even political consequences to that, which I'm sure we'll come back to.
Mm-hmm. Now, just so we can get this out of the way in the beginning, pretty quick in your book, you make the point that it's not whether PTSD is real, but rather that the labeling of conditions and symptoms as PTSD, and that you see a reality far greater than the reality given by medical science. What are you talking about there?
Well, the medical science of it stems from, I hope I don't lose your listeners here, but stems from a positivist notion of science that is that there is something out there to be found, you know, a set of conditions that we can find, and then we go from there if we are medical scientists. You know, that's what the idea of a diagnosis is really based on. But there's a whole other take on the medical profession, and that comes out of what's called the social constructionist literature, really informed by literary traditions, informed particularly by anthropology and by sociology, which says that all of this stuff is more subjective, right? It's not so much as if doctors and other people find something out there. It's that they define what they see out there and to some extent find out there what they go out there looking for. So there's much more of a making of these diagnostic conditions, these diagnostic categories, than there is a finding of those. And what I argue in the book is that, and your words really pick it up very nicely, it's not as though PTSD is not real. The question is, what is its reality? What is its reality? And I argue that its most important reality is political and cultural. That PTSD, the category, PTSD, the concept, has some validity as a diagnostic concept, but it has greater power in the way it works culturally and politically. And that's really what the book is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into that, because you also talk about how this has been honed into a medical alternative to the political discourse of the anti-war veterans movement, which is a pretty powerful statement and one that I think is really important today.
That's kind of what I started with. I think in the first thing I said here in the interview is that it's a different way of looking at war veterans. It's a different set of terms, a different kind of terminology, a different mode of discourse, right? A different way of talking about veterans who are home. Again, the Vietnam veterans come home very political, very much empowered by the wartime experience. They're out in the streets. They've joined the anti-war movement. And a lot of people, including some medical people, mental health medical people looked at that and said, that's really disturbing behavior. That really doesn't conform to the norms of the way veterans come home. So they began to think about this, right? Begin to think about these veterans as people with mental health problems, talking about their political activity as a form of acting out, as a form of catharsis, that these guys are in the streets because they're looking for a way of expressing their emotional upset because of the war, and they're trying to find a new kind of stability in their mental health. And so that, as the anti-war movement wound down, right, and that sort of fades away, and its discourse, which Vietnam veterans had adopted, that discourse begins to fade away. This mental health discourse becomes more and more popular. The press in particular, the New York Times in particular, plays a very great role in putting this new set of terminology into place. That Vietnam veterans are not so much to be listened to politically, but they're to be sympathetic toward, right? These are people who need help, not people who are who have come back from the war ready to help us end the war, right? Which is the way things were in the really early years of the 1970s. And so as the years go along, and again, Hollywood plays a huge role in this, in portraying Vietnam vets really as damaged, as dangerous, even sexually deranged figures like Travis Bickle, you know, in the Taxi film. Lots of characters like that in the portrayal of Vietnam veterans in Hollywood films.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very heavy because a friend of mine, I was talking with her before I left to do this interview, and we were talking, but she had worked with a lot of veterans in Hawaii, and particularly during the Gulf War years, the first Gulf War, and then a little bit later than that, the second one as well. The part of what she was talking about, she said, you know, look, that she worked, there were a lot of Vietnam veterans there who really used to always pose to her that what we should be saying to these guys is, hey, you know what? You want to talk about all the trauma that you went through. You want to talk about this, you want to talk about that. Actually, I'd like to pose to you, if you were piloting the Enola Gay, should you talk about the trauma that was caused to you, or what about the nuclear bomb that you dropped on so many people and responsible for incinerating so many people? When you look at that, there's a real pull, and I think this is part of this thing of what the impact on the movement generally, because there was a very strong relationship between the overall political movement, the radical and revolutionary political movement, and what was going on among the Vietnam vets, sort of separating that off and making people sort of cop to more, I'm physically damaged, I'm mentally damaged, and it's me and what I'm doing. And it shifts the question from the nature of the war to the warriors, which is something that you actually...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's something you really hit on hard.
One of the origins of that shift was President Carter in the late 70s, kind of, I think, maybe coined this phrase, mutual destruction or something like that, that both the United States and Vietnam had suffered mutually from the effects of the war, which, of course, was and is a real fiction. But one of the pieces of that, right, and by the late 70s, this was beginning to creep into the American conversation, was what happened to our men who we sent off to fight the war. You know, look how damaged they have come home. Look over what we have sacrificed for that war. So that was one of the beginning points for this. Now, another twist on this, though, and this twist plays even bigger today, is that the trauma that we inflict on other people, particularly the atrocities that we inflict on other people in Vietnam or in Iraq or in Afghanistan, those get interpreted as being then traumatic experiences of the people who did the inflicting. Much of the mental health literature today is about the trauma that our soldiers have experienced in their experience of inflicting trauma on other people. A great deal of it is that way. And while this is on my mind, too, and this isn't quite on point of this particular question that you ask, but again, particularly with Vietnam, and we're also picking up again on this today, some of the trauma, a lot of the trauma, actually, on Vietnam vets was supposedly endured in the coming home experience. And you see, there again is a tie to the myth of being spat on, that we came home from Vietnam, we weren't welcomed, there weren't parades, we were forgotten, we weren't taken care of, and maybe we were treated badly by the anti-war movement, according to the stories. So that was a traumatic experience. Now, it just occurred to me as I was about to say that there's another new book out. Sebastian Younger's book came out just a few weeks ago, reviewed in Sunday's New York Times, that we need to do better about welcoming our veterans back. Now, I haven't read his book, but I did read his article in Vanity Fair magazine, by the way, about a year ago, I think. There's a theme in there. There's a subtext in there that somehow we're not doing right by our people when they come home. And this is part of the problematic mental health experience that the entire war experience leaves with our veterans. It's the coming home experience. It's the after-war experience. It's what happens after we send them off to do this terrible damage, right, to these other people. It's what happens there. And, of course, finally, and I'm sure this is part of your question, too, it really writes out of our history, writes out, it erases, it elides from our memory what these wars were really about, right? And certainly the people who are victims of these wars in other countries, that's really gone. And we end up talking about our own soldiers. We end up talking about our own veterans rather than what the politics of the war, politics and economics of the war, what it was really about.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jerry Lemke, and we're talking about his really powerful book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. And I'm telling you, folks, you got to get this book, you got to read it, all right? Because especially the times that we're living in today, you absolutely have to be.
By the way, it's out in a new paperback edition, so it's a little less expensive than what the original hardcover was.
Okay, good. I don't care if they had to pay a bucket of gold for it, though. They need to read it. Okay, that's the thing.
Oh, thanks for that.
Sure, definitely. Well, let's jump into something else around here, because I definitely don't want to leave out this question of the role of culture, the overall cultural scene in this country in relation to what's being promoted around both PTSD and the current thing, which we should talk about first probably, is the current version of PTSD, which is traumatic brain injury. Let's talk about that, the link between those. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, first of all, the big cultural piece on this, and I just want to prompt you on this in case, you know, we otherwise wouldn't get back to it, but the other wording in my subtitle is post-empire America.
Mm-hmm. I think that
this trauma narrative really plays into that in very, very dangerous ways. But again, that's something that we can come back to. The traumatic brain injury part on this is so interesting. And gosh, I think what listeners need to do is they need to connect that up with shell shock of the World War I period. In the book, I quote a Washington Post reporter as saying that traumatic brain injury, TBI, we'll shorthand that, TBI has brought back one of the worst afflictions of World War I, shell shock. That's pretty much a quote right from the book. The irony in that is that shell shock, even by the end of World War I, was completely discredited as a diagnostic category. And so to say that TBI now brings that back, people who know that history, that mental health history, kind of look at that and say, that's a strange thing to be saying, because this reporter was very much into kind of promoting the legitimacy and the validity of TBI, but he obviously doesn't know that history. But here's the takeaway question, right, on TBI. You got to ask yourself, what is the word traumatic doing in there? What is the T in there? We know there's such a thing as brain injury. Car accident, your skull hits the dashboard, the brain hits the skull, you have a brain injury. That's a concussion, all right? That is a biological, organic a condition. So you don't need the word trauma in that, right? If you have a brain injury, you could say, well, of course a brain injury is traumatic, right, or can be traumatic. And why does it get added in when it gets added in? And by the way, I did the research on this. It's a very late addition. It really only comes sometime around in the 1990s. So all this history of war injuries, brain injuries in war, of course brain injuries in war, none of it has the word trauma or traumatic attached to it until the 1980s. Now, here's what happens, is that this concept of PTSD, as we've already talked about, is problematic, right? It's biological or it's organic. Validity is just not there. People have been looking since the term came into play in around 1980, went into the DSM in 1980. People have been looking for some sort of biomarker, is the term that they look for, something that will prove to their satisfaction, right, that PTSD is real, that in some minds, some medical mental health minds, it's really not real until it shows up on a microscope, right? There's got to be something. So what they went looking for was this biomarker, this kind of the holy grail, right, of PTSD. Now, it's the link between PTSD and brain injury. The word traumatic is in there to create the idea that PTSD, which we'll say now is trauma qua trauma, psychological, emotional disorder, right, of a psychological nature, right, causes some sort of brain injury, causes something that is organic, something that is biological, something that would be the biomarker. So the search now, right, is to find some kind of link between PTSD and brain injury. So the word trauma in there is a kind of a bridge term, supposedly, ostensibly, to connect the two up. But as of my last reading of the literature, it's not there. I mean, there are articles that you can read, you know, and there are newspaper stories that, you know, that might have the headline that kind of give you the impression that, aha, they found it. But you read into the story and you know, what you see is all the qualifications that the research still has a long way to go and so on and so forth. So it's not there. Will it ever be there? I'm skeptical, but then I'm not a quote-unquote scientist, right, in that sense. There are people who say that, yes, you know, emotional upset can leave traces in the brain, and those can be permanent. Can be? Well, anytime you say can be, you know, it's a maybe, and it's the other side of that is, well, maybe not, right? That's where I think that's at, and I think that's what listeners need to, that question of why is trauma there? Who puts that word trauma there? How is the word trauma in that position supposed to function, culturally speaking? That's really your question, I think. How does it work? How does it work in the American conversation? How does it work in American culture?
You know, it's something very important in terms of the character of the wars, what happened in the aftermath of the wars, the losing of the Vietnam War, just the horror that's been inflicted on the people all throughout the world, in the Middle East in particular, and the inability of the U.S. to declare sort of another great victory and bring Caesar, a new crown to Caesar in D.C., right? The basic point is that there's a whole thing here of this. What I'm bringing that up for is because, one, there's a lot to dig into there, but there's a particular element which I find very troubling and important for our listeners here, is that in the midst of all this, particularly lately, and since there's been the Iraq Veterans Against the War and then these various hearings that developed, and the people themselves, there's been a unity between a lot of what the right is saying in society about the wounded warriors and the importance of taking care of them and, you know, standing with them, and what the left has been saying, a lot using the wounded warriors as a way to sort of have a backdoor into a conversation with people. But it promotes, to me,
absolutely,
it ends up promoting the same thing.
Well, I think that's right. I think that if what you're saying, that it's sort of a right woos left, to use Chip Berlay's term, right woos left. The right comes up with this stuff that's very seductive. And some people on the left, you know, particularly the liberal left, buy into that and play into that. The real danger here is that this wounded warrior stuff, the victim veteran stuff, the traumatized veteran stuff, is really a metaphor for a wounded nation, a traumatized people, a traumatized nation. And again, what listeners have to do to make sense of this, you go back to post-World War I Germany. The shell-shocked German veteran in Germany was a metaphor for the wounded Germany, and it played out that way in German literature. It played out that way in early German film in the 1920s. There's a great, great book on this called Shell Shock Cinema. Listeners have got to get that book. It's called Shell Shock Cinema, subtitled Weimar Germany and something. Because once you see that, then you think about what's going on in the United States today and you say, oh my God, right? It's the same thing. We are much more slowly than it happened in Germany, but we are slowly being moved by that wounded nation narrative. That there's two features of this. One is that we need to rehab ourselves, find our new confidence by rearming, by going back into the war, by showing ourselves, first of all, that we are the right stuff, showing ourselves that we could have won the last war if we had not been sold out on the home front. That, of course, played heavily in World War I Germany, also as the stab in the back legend, right?
Yeah.
We can do all that again. But what plays even more powerfully today is that so much of our understanding of how these wars abroad are being fought is based on psychological operations, psychological warfare, propaganda, stealth. I mean, you almost really can't talk about terrorism except as stealth, as sneakiness, as the dangers of the unseen, right? That's what terrorism is all about. You know, what's the real damage of terrorism, right? It's terror. We're terrorized. We're traumatized, we Americans. So seeing our enemy in that way, as a traumatizing enemy, that licenses then our use of similar kinds of warfare, drone warfare, right? Why is it justified? Well, we're fighting terrorists. We're fighting people who struck us first using the implements of terror, and so we strike back in that same kind of way. And that's why the words post-empire America are in the subtitle of my book. Post-empire. We are living through the throes, the pangs of a post-empire period of history, and there is somewhat of a rule of thumb, right, that empires in decline are very, very dangerous, very, very vicious political animals. And we really need to consider that is the path that we have placed ourselves on with this trauma narrative. And back to your point, the imagery, the storyline, the coming home storyline of veterans as traumatized, as hurt, as damaged, damages and injuries that are unseen, the unseen wound, all of this stuff is a playground, right, for the imaginations of a nation itself, a people itself that is traumatized and needs to get back on its horse and go back into war. Mm-hmm. It's very, very dangerous.
Now, just in relation to this, I just want to actually go back to a point that you've been making a lot about the role of culture and culture in playing all this. Because, you know, you mentioned a couple things in your book that I wanted to dig into a little. And one is the story of Kimberly Dozier and her book and who she was and what happened to her. And frankly, she was a really stand-alone and stand-out example of what people should be looking for in this society today in relation to people who have, you know, are speaking out about this war and what happens there. And then you also talk about something which I think is shocking on the other end of it, the role of things like HBO, MTV, the broader culture, the culture that actually is so many, you know, I mean, when you say HBO and MTV, you feel like you're talking about 10 times the U.S. population, you know, the way it goes out all over the world. And what was portrayed there in terms of Kanye West and what he did, and then James Gandolfini and what he did. You know, these are very important things that people don't necessarily connect up with, you know, this whole dying empire, you know, this post-empire America. So let's talk about Kimberly Dozier first and then that.
Kimberly Dozier was a CBS News reporter who was badly wounded in Iraq, very badly wounded in Iraq. And her story, briefly, the important part of her story is one of doctors trying to cast her in this PTSD role. She was physically very, very damaged. And so they kept prompting her, right, to counter the coming effects of PTSD. And she kept saying, I'm not going to go down that road, which didn't mean that she didn't have her scary moments and all this. She writes about all this in the book. But in the end, she's really a stand-up person whose case really exposes the imposition of PTSD by mental health professionals on people, and how strong, in this case, somebody had to be in order to push back on that. And I contrast her case in the book with that of Bob Woodruff, the ABC correspondent, who was also injured in an explosion in Iraq, but much, much less seriously than Kimberly Dozier was. And he, as I write about it, he plays right into that, right? And he's one of the key figures in the story of how TBI, traumatic brain injury, comes to be viewed as such a valid notion. And I think it plays a huge part. And I show in the book how the number of citations in the mental health journals increases after Bob Woodruff's story airs as a major primetime viewing story on ABC, and after his book comes out, with number one bestseller, his book, on the New York Times bestseller list. His book on basically how he comes to identify with and be identified with traumatic brain injury. And I go through that book and I really deconstruct that story. And so in my book, then, I counterpose the Bob Woodruff story with the Kimberly Dozier story. And there are other ways that you allude to. There's great stuff. The Kanye West program on, maybe you can help me
MTV.
Out here. Okay, MTV, yes. And he, you know, he does this unannounced visitation to Iraq War veterans who have been diagnosed with PTSD. And he visits them, and then, of course, he invites them to his next concert, and they get to meet Pharrell and all these other stars. So, of course, I mean, it makes Kanye West look like a great guy, right? But it also has a way, very powerful way, of validating, particularly for young people who are watching this show, for crying out loud, validating the diagnostic properties of traumatic brain injury and of PTSD. I mean, PTSD is all part of the same story. So I write about that in some detail. I write about it. So I think readers will find that kind of interesting as a deconstruction of popular culture, really.
Exactly, and the need to really pay attention in those arenas. And one last question, and we have about 3 minutes for you to answer it, so I know it's not fair, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Embrace the Horror. What a great name for the last chapter of this book, all right? What's going on here?
Well, yeah, thanks for that. I'm glad you liked it. That line comes from Apocalypse Now. If we're going to win these wars, we need to be as horrific as our enemies. We need to be able to do all the atrocious things that our enemies do. That was the line, and that was the narrative, one of the narratives that came out of that movie, Apocalypse Now. And what I'm saying in that chapter is that we are back. That is where we went after the 1978 movie, Apocalypse Now. We went in that direction, and that direction has taken us to where we are now. I mean, we even celebrate now, for crying out loud. We celebrate a lot of the losses in war. Again, that's That's part of the credentialing of the real warrior, right? The guy who comes home as an amputee or the guy who comes home psychologically damaged. That's what we want to see because that validates who we are as a people. We can send our people off to suffer damage just as much as our enemies can. And that's really the point of that chapter. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the drone warfare and how so much of that is carried out now by these people who sit in Las Vegas, New Jersey, or North Carolina, or Texas, or wherever, and they basically end up firing off drones from the safety of that, where they never see up front what's going on. And the people in these villages and whatnot, living under this constant terror, you know, which is really horrific. If you ever look into how these drone strikes are carried out, you know, they hit once, and then they wait for people to come out and see if they can, how their relatives are doing, is there anybody left alive or needing help, and then they come in and hit again. And all day before the drones even are fired off, any particular drone, while they're all they sort of cruise the sky, leaving people to wonder exactly when is it going to fall, exactly when is it going to hit. So people live in terror as they see the war, as they see the drone missile, and then they see at the same time they live in the aftermath of that, which is even more horrible. Let's talk about that a minute in relation to what you're talking about just now.
Oh well, I think your words capture very well what is going on the ground. For those people, what's really interesting is that PTSD has come to be applied to the people who are flying those drones from Arizona or Montana or wherever they sit. And I think that's part of the need of, maybe not even so much the need for them, but the need for the American people to understand, to understand what they're doing as being real warfare and of them as being real warriors. So again, the supposed mental health condition of trauma is a way of credentialing their warriorhood. Yeah. And then the stuff is really insidious, right? The people involved in this case, the people who are flying the drones, do pick this stuff up, right, and adopt it as an identity for themselves. It's almost irresistible, I think, when the culture almost demands that you see yourself in the way that the culture sees you, right, that it's hard to resist. And we know this, right, from other kinds of class studies of racial identities, that the dominant culture is very, very powerful. British PTSD rates are about 1/4 of those from Americans. And some British scholars say it's because Americans expect their soldiers to come home traumatized. Huh. And so the soldiers play to that expectation. I mean, it's good old-fashioned sociology. Wow. There's no reason to think that drone pilots, right, aren't affected, and you could say affected in very negative ways by the same thing, yeah. Right, that they take on those identities for themselves and probably end up in a psychiatrist's office, right, being treated for war trauma.
All right, Jerry Lemke, thank you very much, man. Thank you very much for the book and for coming on and doing this interview.
All right, you're very welcome.
Okay. All right, talk to you again soon. Stay in touch, man.
Sure, all right, bye.
Thanks. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jerry Lemke, the author of PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. All right, it's a very, very heavy book, and Jerry is an associate professor emeritus of sociology at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts, and his other books include The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and the Fantasies of Betrayal. Once again, that's Jerry Lemke. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Breaking up big rocks on a chain gang, breaking rocks and saving my time. Breaking rocks out here on a chain gang, cause I've been convicted of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Yeah, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got the table long to go. I commit the crime, Lord, I need it. Crime of being hungry and poor. Left the grocery store man bleeding when he caught me robbing his store. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. There I reckon that ought to get it. Been waking and waking, but I still got so terrible long to go. And did you say 5 years hard labor on the chain gang, you guanaco? I heard the judge say 5 years of labor but I still got the table long to go.
All right, all right. Welcome back. That's Oscar Brown Jr., the late Oscar Brown Jr. with Work Song. And that's a perfect intro to our next segment because we're going to be talking about, yes, get ready for it, folks, debtor's prisons, all right? Yeah, I know. I was kind of shocked, too, when I heard it. But I actually found out the extent of all this. I found that out because I saw an article in the LA Times talking about an ACLU lawsuit in Washington State that recently succeeded in ending the practice of locking people up for unpaid court costs in Benton County. And it talked about these debtors' prisons being very common in many states in the U.S. And I thought, what the hell? Really? So I wanted to talk to people about this. Right? And I found two people that I was really excited to be able to reach out to and to talk to. And first is Prachi Dave, who's the staff attorney of the ACLU of Washington State. And we're also going to be joined by Nusrat Chowdhury, who's the staff attorney for the ACLU in New York. Prachi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Nusrat, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, sure. And Nusrat, I'm going to start by asking Prachi some questions first, just so we can get a little bit of the particulars about what happened in Benton County, Washington, because that was kind of a mind blower. Prachi, what actually did happen?
Well, we had found through several months of investigation that what Benton County was doing is instituting a practice of jailing or threatening to jail or forcing manual labor on people who couldn't afford their legal financial obligations that were imposed on them by the county. So what we had found is that at least over a snapshot of time, so over a six-month period of time, at least 320 people were jailed in the Benton County Jail simply because they were too poor to pay the legal financial obligations imposed on them by the county. And when we talk about the legal financial obligations, we're just talking about the money that was owed as part of the sentence. Many of these individuals had completed all of the other aspects of any of the sentences that they had in the county.
Boy, so basically, when you talk about numbers of people, is this really prevalent? What are the numbers involved here?
Well, in the complaint for Benton County, we listed the 320 people who we had investigated over that six-month period of time. But considering the length of time that these practices have continued, we estimate that these numbers are in the thousands.
Wow, in the thousands. Well, let's talk about one particular person, just so people can get a sense of what's going on. Jane Fuentes.
Yeah, so Janie Fuentes is one of the plaintiffs as part of our lawsuit, and she is a great example of the number of different kinds of impacts that debtor's prison system, like the one run by Benton County, can have on the individual. One of the things that Janie experienced was that when she was released from her sentence in 2013, she was unemployed, she was disabled, and she was trying to get her life together. However, the county kept on coming after her for these legal financial obligations. So even though she was unemployed, she was expected to pay legal financial obligations to the county, and she wasn't able to get her life back together. She constantly had warrants issued for her arrest, which meant that she would have to keep on going back to jail or labor on work crew, when in fact she could have been spending all of that time looking for employment for herself, looking for stable housing. And these are really the ways that legal financial obligations set people like Janie Fuentes back and don't allow them to move forward from these convictions that they put behind them a very long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, the ACLU recently went to court over this. Can you tell people sort of in a concentrated way, what was your court case? What were you pressing? What were you fighting? And you won. What does that mean?
Well, the court case was an attempt to go after the entire system that had been instituted by the county. The things that we had found that the county was imprisoning people and placing them on work crew, basically manual labor, because they couldn't pay. But they weren't determining any whether or not they could pay. They weren't looking at their poverty levels. They weren't looking at the fact that many of these individuals were on disability or below the poverty line. That kind of analysis was not being done on an individual basis before these individuals were jailed. That meant that many and just the majority of individuals who were caught up in this system were indigent. And so what the lawsuit intended to do was to put an end to that system by requiring that any time the county wanted to impose any kind of sanction because individuals were unable to pay their LFOs, requiring that the county does a detailed analysis of whether or not these people can actually pay their LFOs. Are they actually too poor to pay their LFOs? If they are too poor to pay these financial obligations, then what the settlement says is that they cannot face the kinds of sanctions that the county had imposed on them previously. And it does require that individuals can go back to court and ask for a waiver or reduction of their legal financial obligations, again, because they are too indigent, they are unable to pay these legal financial obligations that were imposed on them. In addition, it does require that the main players, meaning the prosecution and the public defenders in the jurisdiction, are to undergo training so that these questions of ability to pay can be properly presented to the court, and these individuals who are looking at sanctions simply because they are unable to pay are properly represented.
All right, Prachi, we're going to move on to Nusrat for a minute now. And Nusrat, I wanted to talk to you about this because you can step back and look at this thing in a national context. What the hell is going on? Just what is debtor's prison and how prevalent is it? How widespread is this in the country today?
Well, yeah, your surprise is warranted because nearly two centuries ago, the United States formally abolished the incarceration of people who couldn't pay off debts owed in the civil context. But what we've witnessed is that especially since the economic recession, since 2010, that cities and counties, state courts around the country, urban and rural, north, south, spanning the Pacific Northwest to the Deep South, are in fact jailing people simply because they're too poor to pay court-imposed fines and fees. What we saw in Benton County were people who were recriminalized after serving their sentences and doing their time when they were saddled with these fines and fees related to their conviction. In other places, we see people criminalized simply because they can't pay fines and fees for traffic offenses, civil infractions, things that they wouldn't even normally carry jail time. Yet they are being arrested and jailed simply because they're poor.
You know, it's just mind-blowing because I keep thinking about this and I'm thinking like, okay, how do they get away with this? You know, it reminds me of that story of Doug Blackman in his book, Slavery by Another Name, where he talked about how this had been going on after slavery had apparently, you know, had been supposedly defeated on one level, but it was actually being continued to be carried out in certain parts of the South. There was similar circumstances where people, if they were picked up and they didn't have enough money in their pocket to not be declared vagrant, then if they were declared vagrant, then they would end up being enslaved in these mines that supported the growth of the industry in the North. And he said that at one point, when Roosevelt was getting ready to go to war, and he said, all right, look, he had a meeting of his cabinet. He said, we have to figure out, okay, is there anything that somebody could pull our coattail on? Is there anything we really should know about that we could get into this war and we're supposed to be fighting for the high and mighty image and all this stuff of goodness? And is there anything that could maybe cause us a little problem? This guy in the corner said, yeah, there's this thing about slavery in the South. It's still going on. And you're kind of looking at this and you're thinking, what is it? What, you know, when you're talking about the numbers of this, what's behind the push to do this? And how do they get away with this? Because you would think that, as you said, it was ruled unconstitutional, was ruled illegal a long time ago. And there were other court cases that sort of reemphasized that, but yet it still goes on. What's happening here?
Well, the Supreme Court made clear more than 30 years ago that jailing people simply because they can't afford to pay a fine is contrary to core American values of fairness and equality embedded in the 14th Amendment. Yet what we've seen is that as public budgets have shrunk, as state governments have cut off funding for local governments, that there's this disturbing trend towards relying on the collection of court-imposed fines and fees as a source of revenue. And that revenue can be for a court or it can be for the government that runs the court, like a municipality. So we're seeing this rise in revenue generation at the expense of the poor, and there is no question that this creates a two-tiered system of justice, one that treats rich people and people of means far more fairly and with less punitive sanctions than those who are poor. And that two-tier system of justice is racially skewed. The Department of Justice highlighted this in its investigation of Ferguson. It concluded that the policing practices in that city were driven by a quest for revenue by the municipal government. And in a lawsuit filed by the ACLU in 2015 against DeKalb County, Georgia, we found exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about this in terms of the, you know, I keep thinking again, this is a lot bigger than I think anybody knows about or even people who have some inkling of it. It's sort of a little mind-boggling, as we were saying, and enraging. And I keep thinking about this thing of, You know, on the one hand, there's the argument, okay, well, and I know this is, you know, there's an argument built around this whole thing of, well, the more they have these debtors' prisons, the more they have bring people in here, that there's money that the states are that are getting, that the courts are getting. But there's also been quite a few examples, and I think even in the report that the ACLU did, there's a lot of examples where actually doing this, pursuing these debtors' prisons things, actually end up costing more money than they would ever get. It costs them more money than they would get than a person even owes. The thing I'm wondering is, like, there's a lot of this is not just tied up with to me it seems like, okay, you can say there's maybe a matter of revenue coming to the state or the counties or whatever, but there also seems this can't be separated from the overall, you know, repression that's going on, and particularly directed against Black and Latino people, and the whole thing of the new Jim Crow, because you look at this kind of thing, and this is who's being targeted a lot. You know, poor people of color. And then you're kind of looking at it and you're thinking, okay, there's a lot of different ways that this falls out. Alice Goffman wrote about the impact of people not being able to pay their court fees when they're, or their, you know, what's going on with them, their fines or whatever in Philadelphia. And that means they don't show up for their new hearings. And so they end up going to jail once the police catch up for them, because there's a whole basis built on this. But there's a lot of this stuff that really actually to me seems to have a repressive aspect to it too.
Absolutely. I mean, we see again and again in places where the courts are focused on revenue generation rather than promoting public safety, that communities feel alienated and they fear calling the police. I've spoken to domestic violence survivors who, when they call the police for help, they were the ones who were arrested because they owed fines and fees, and that city was using arrest warrants to collect those debts. So rather than encouraging people to reach out to the police, these practices generate fear, distrust, and panic in low-income communities, and particularly communities of color. On your point on cost, you are correct. Too many courts and cities and counties aren't doing the math properly. Jailing people costs money. But what we've seen in places where we've investigated in depth and looked at the budgets is that the revenue generation is the result of people's families being panicked and in pure desperation, using public assistance funds, things that they would use for basic necessities just to get their loved ones out of jail. So maybe there is money coming in, but it's money that really should be going to support people's basic needs. And the real accounting isn't done, because they're simply not accounting for the cost of jailing and for diverting police officers from managing threats to public safety, from responding to calls for service, and turning them instead into debt collectors.
Well, debt collectors who are on vacation from their normal career of killing, okay, imprisoning. Let me ask you this. When you're talking about that, I want to know exactly, can you give us a sense of actually, I just need to get a sense of like the numbers of people. Are we talking millions of people that are getting caught up in this? And then the ACLU also has a project that they're doing around this. Can you tell us what that project is too?
Well, it's hard to quantify the numbers across the country, but as Prachi explained, in any given jurisdiction, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are being jailed or coerced to pay money that they can't afford to pay or subjected to manual labor. So we sued one Mississippi town where, in a simple 9-month span, more than 415 people had been booked to jail and were unable to pay anything and therefore were kept there. They were deprived of their liberty because they couldn't pay a fine or a fee. In Ferguson, like nearly most of the population had numerous warrants out against them and lots of people were jailed. So it's hard to kind of quantify exactly how many people, definitely in the thousands. And the question is, if we're getting to the millions, not sure. But what we do know is that the ACLU alone, and we're just one organization working on these issues, has exposed and challenged debtors' prisons in Colorado, Georgia, Louisiana, Maine, Michigan, Mississippi, New Hampshire, Ohio, Washington, and Florida. So these practices are widespread, and we need to look for them and challenge them everywhere they take place.
And how has it been going with the project you've been working on?
So we have been exposing and challenging these practices through litigation and public awareness, as well as advocacy with judges, and there have been really optimistic moves for reform by state court administrators, city leaders, who get that these practices are unfairly punitive and create this racially skewed two-tiered system of justice.
All right,
last month in Michigan, the Supreme Court amended its rules to help prevent failure to pay, leading people to being jailed. And the city of Biloxi has adopted sweeping reforms that provide a model for local governments on how to not criminalize the poor.
All right, Nusrat, real quick, where can people find out more about what the ACLU is doing and about this whole situation?
ACLU.org is our website, and if you search for Ending Modern Day Debtors Prisons at ACLU.org, you will find where we're working on this issue across the country.
All right, I want to thank both of you folks. Prachi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having
okay.
me.
And Nusrat, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, take care now. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we were just talking with Prachi Dave, the staff attorney of the ACLU at Washington State, and with Nusrat Chowdhury, the staff attorney for the ACLU located in New York, and we've been talking about debtors' prisons. All right, and this has been a very interesting show, and I hope you're going to be chewing on a lot of material for thought now. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I want to thank my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Matt Quiklinski. And I also want to thank my board op for today, my engineer, Teddy Robinson. Great to have you back, Teddy. And each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out now with Outer National and We Are All Illegals.
Somos ilegales.